Welcome back to episode 140, I believe.
140, wow.
140. So, tonight we agreed to talk about protesting, or the right to assemble, as it was originally called. Protesting, does it actually work? Can it be manipulated? Well, obviously, yes. the right to protest and protesting itself. The idea of getting into the streets, showing up with, people, some of your friends, and carrying signs and chanting and burning select politicians in effigy. All that good stuff. It's good optics, especially in the 20th century. It's development of photography and, film, these things. There's a certain aesthetic to it, particularly on the left, the left-wing protest. We get into it, seem to get all the good press for reasons I think we can discuss for the most part. Well, the right to assemble, it is recognized as a human right and protected in the First Amendment of the United States Constitution under the clause, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or the press or the right of the people to peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Of course, widespread mass protests became sort of a characteristic of the 20th, and of course, the 21st century we're in now for sort of civic engagement. We have examples of big protest marches. There was the very famous March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. This is Martin Luther King's March on Washington. In August 1963, approximately 250,000 people participated in this march. This was a civil rights march. This is where Dr. King delivered his I Have a Dream speech. There were the anti-war protests of the 1960s. The biggest one, reportedly, was the anti-war Vietnam protest in Washington, D.C. in 1969. About 500,000 to 600,000 people demonstrated against the Vietnam War in the nation's capital. And this coalition started organizing smaller rallies a couple years before, which culminated in this big protest 2 years later. There was anti-nuke marches. I remember those from the 80s. This was the biggest one was in June 1982, the anti-nuclear march in Central Park. Millions protested and filled Central Park. I think celebrities showed up and sang, a lot of the acts of the day who entertained the protesters. In the 1990s, there was a Million Man March. 1993, I remember this one. There was a huge March on Washington for lesbians, gays, and bi-equal rights. A gay liberation march. This was April 25th, 1993. They say about 800,000 people converged on the National Mall for this protest. This was sort of the coming out of the gay rights movement. This was the early days of the Clinton administration. Not the coming out, sort of maybe it's coming of age. This one, throughout the 90s and even today, gay rights have been sort of gay activism, gay lesbian activism has been legitimized sort of by the mainstream press and the establishment, heavily promoted. And we can get into that, why that is. Of course, in 2003, there was a very large march, February 2003, against George Bush's decision to go to war against Iraq. Around the nation, 15 million people marched in 600 cities around the world in 2003. At least 500,000 people were reported protesting in American cities, including New York City and Los Angeles. This didn't receive much coverage at the time. So, in contrast to the protest marches of the 1960s, the press underestimated, didn't give it get its proper coverage, at least given the size of it, its reported size. Whether or not they have an effect or not, we can discuss that. They always have an effect, because the question on are they being staged or manipulated for a ulterior motive or secret agenda. There's other examples like the Tea Party movement, which did culminate in some sort of political consequences, because that led to the Republican retaking the Congress in the midterm of Obama's first administration. Going back a little further, the Bonus Army March in Washington, D.C., that's when tens of thousands of protesters, many of them were World War I veterans, and their families descended in Washington, D.C. in the hot summer of 1932 to pressure Congress to pass legislation awarding them some deferred bonuses they desperately needed to cope with the Great Depression. This was, of course, the protests got a little unruly, The protests got a little violent, and that's when the army was sent in to disperse it. This was led by General Douglas MacArthur. I think at the time he might have been a colonel, but I'm not sure. I think he was a general by then. I think Eisenhower was there, and so were Patton. So was Patton. Because some say this produced a backlash, which contributed to Herbert Hoover's landslide defeat to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So we can talk about more recent protests and how they were treated in the press, or how they were subverted or sort of delegitimized in the press, and what's it all about. So that's protesting. So Joe, you kind of came of age in the 60s, or at least have a living memory of it.
Well,
the age of protests. So what's your take on it?
Yeah, and I was thinking about all of the protests that I've been in, and gee whiz, it's just dozens of them. Mm-hmm. The first one I ever was involved in was at Century City in September. It would be September 1967. And because LBJ was going to have this big fat cat dinner in one of these big restaurants. I mean, Century City is this, you know, Masonic cesspool. If you ever see a helicopter shot, but they have a big Masonic eye right in the middle of the thing. You
Isn't
know,
it it's, like all modernist
It's anti-human, you know, geometric forms and shapes. It's just, it's where the attorneys are.
It's where they filmed one of the Planet of the Apes there, I think, didn't they?
I think they did.
Birth of the Planet of the Apes. Yeah, it's very modern.
Very modern. Yeah. And so maybe not the first, but certainly was the first big media anti-Vietnam protest. And I went because I was 18 and I didn't really want to go to college. Yet if I didn't, I was going to get drafted. So the draft was really, you know, that was in the minds of people, and a group of us went, and boy, it was life changing because, you know, there was thousands of people and they were chanting, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" That was the chant. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty peaceful, and everyone was kind of just milling around there. You don't really know where you're going to go. You know, there's thousands of people. And there was a huge police presence and a military presence. The military guys were up on top with the automatic weapons. You know, I mean, it was pretty militarized. But anyway, at a certain point, a group of people, a lot of them women, they sat down on the road. They actually just sat down on the road. That was what their protest was. And the police descended on him. And I was off to the side, but it wasn't that far away, 20 yards maybe. And I saw the people just get slaughtered. I mean, it was shocking to me. I'd never seen anything like that. The absolute, you know, just cruel violence. There's pictures. I've seen pictures of like how many just brain damaged kids there were because they're hitting them in the head. Mm-hmm. And the image that really stood out in my mind was one cop pulled his hand back to smack this kid. It was a woman, and the baton flew out of his hand because he brought it. And the baton flew like 20 feet in the air. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, violent force that was getting used against the First Amendment right, you know, kind of exercising citizens. And so that stood out in my mind. And then that was in 67, 68. I happened to be going to school in Paris, and
you're there, yeah.
I was there, yeah. I caught some of the protests leading up. Now I was smart enough to get out before the thing exploded, but I could see it about to happen, and you know, saw the protests, and you just knew what was going to blow up. I have been in protests in Chile when Allende was threatened. It looked like the CIA or, you know, whoever, the military in Chile was going to get rid of their people who protested that. That was a very dangerous protest to be in. I really had a creepy feeling about it. And then I was in protests of, again, in the Vietnam War, like in Berkeley, UCSB, the burning of the Bank of America. I was involved with that one. And then my most recent protest was I was in the streets of Catalonia, or actually in Barcelona, for those last summer for the Catalonia Independence Day, which is September 11th, by the way. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea what I was doing, but I had pamphlets and it was just, you know, I was kind of wandering around. But the point is, so I've been to protests, been to a lot of them, and others too. I've been to just a ton of these protests. They never do anything. And in hindsight, I could have skipped them all because I didn't really understand that the government was something other than, you know, a thing that would respond to protests. The problem with protesting is that it's like look at the Vietnam War protests, right? What I didn't understand was both the Vietnam War and the counterculture that was protesting against it. And by the way, drugs were everywhere at these protest events here in like, you know, the UCs, Berkeley, and people were smoking marijuana, taking LSD. There was just all kinds of drug use. I didn't understand that they were just both, you know, sides of a Masonic coin, and that this was basically just a way to debase a whole generation, you know, basically to make us crazy. And also, you know, in the case of the war, there was no military or political purpose. It was just, they were just shattering the minds of the baby boomer. The baby boomer, because it was such a large demographic bulge and because it was so Catholic, as you point out, it was a special target. And they got at us, you know, with MK Ultra, with the acid test parties, you know, Woodstock, all this on the one side. And then, of course, Vietnam War on the other. Man, by, you know, like 73, 74, we were ready for the disco. You know, we had just been shattered. And so we were protesting. I mean, there were protests, you know, in favor of the Vietnam War as well as opposed to it. Most of the protests that are well known are opposed to it. But we didn't, none of us understood or had the slightest idea that there was a, you know, kind of a broader purpose for these things. We didn't understand how society could be controlled and how we could be controlled. I mean, that, so there, none of the protests that I was involved with ever accomplished anything whatsoever, really. I mean, you could say that the Century City protest was part of the reason that LBJ didn't get reelected, but who cares? I mean, you know, there was just one Masonic cesspool after another. It didn't matter if it was LBJ or Nixon or whoever, you know, it was going to be someone from the same guild, though we didn't understand that in the protest. And so anyway, so I was just going to say that the protests that really had, I think, have been useful have been the protests from the truth movement about 9/11. They've gotten a few of these protest marches where they're chanting, you know, it's an inside job and Geraldo Rivera is forced to basically, you know, badmouth them. And I think that kind of protest, which is basically for the purpose of spreading information, is really what is useful. And so the protests that I would, you know, want to take part of in the future are not ones that basically have political goals, because I mean, in a direct sense, because I don't think you can really get at politics. I think it's a closed shop. It's a secret society. We have no idea really what these people are about, but they're not about us. They're representing us. So what we need are information protests where the information that can help people see what the government is more clearly is the focus of the protests. In other words, what we're protesting is ignorance. And what we hope to accomplish with the protest is education.
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, the idea that you can go arrange a mass protest and the authorities are going to respect your First Amendment right, you know, make sure you get the permit, and you can arrange your mass protest and hopefully when the numbers show up and tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people show up, it's going to put pressure on the elected representatives to consider your interests and in legislation. That's a little naive, I think. That's type of assembly, sort of a Norman Rockwell idea of democracy. It really isn't how it functions. I mean, even without getting conspiratorial, people understand that money is what guides politics, and so people, those with money, are going to have more money, going to have more votes. It's a dollar democracy. A good example is a pro-life protest where you have like a couple people standing outside an abortion clinic, and they're witnessing prevents one woman from going in and terminating her unborn child's life, that protest has made a big difference, whether we realize it or not. And so, you know, it's important to have modest goals, realistic goals in these things. Things you can, you know, start a revolution through a protest and somehow be able to control the situation, and you'll be in power and you'll be able to perfect or improve society. It's, you know, you have to be more realistic about that. But it, you know, if you can cite successful protests, meaning them having political implications in law and changing the culture, of course, the most common or most well-known example of that would be the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s, when you had marches on various southern cities, march on Selma. You had the 1963 Civil Rights March, which culminated in the Civil Rights Act, and this was the Civil Rights Revolution. But why was it successful politically? It was successful politically because the establishment wanted it to be successful politically. It didn't take on the establishment. In fact, the hidden grammar of the Civil Rights Movement was you had elites supporting it because they were carrying out an ulterior agenda. Martin Luther King had funding from the Rockefellers, and he had funding from the organized Jewry, Stanley Levinson. And it was mobilized to carry out a regime change operation in the South. There is a lot of evidence to suggest a lot of the violence in the South was fomented by the FBI, sort of like a operation, you know, like a COINTELPRO type operation, where, or like we see today, where, you know, terrorist groups are then, you know, they have implants going in fomenting problems, and then they become the solution, because they didn't want the South to resolve the issue internally. They wanted a pretext for federal control and expansion of federal power, and they got that with the Civil Rights Act because of the problems in the South, which was then telecasted to the nation by the major networks, which were all controlled by the powers that be. And so it was successful because the establishment wanted the Civil Rights Movement to be successful. So when it came to street protests, it would be set up that there'd be violence, so you could film the violence, and then you could show that to the rest of the country. That would undermine the legitimacy of Southern governments, and the FBI was a big part of this. And so a part of this was also many Southern government officials, like Chief Bull Connor, and that. But it was kind of set up for that. And it was, and a lot of people don't realize is the problems then were antagonized by the federal government's involvement. They weren't solved by it. It's a fundamental change in sort of the narrative down there. When you kind of look at it, same way today that, you know, that the FBI will foment terrorist plots and then announce that, you know, they've been arrested and stopped and these things. You know, so that type of thing. And we do know that, you know, with Operation Keras and the CIA and COINTELPRO, that the FBI was involved in that. So it was allowed to succeed because it was part of the agenda. Same thing with the feminist marches and protests and the subsequent gay rights of the Stonewall and the promotion of gay rights protests. And I mentioned that 93 rally, the gay rights protest in 93 in Washington, D.C. You get all the positive press because the establishment wanted to promote homosexuality, because, you know, the establishment wants that because they want everyone to have, you know, they want the lower birth rates, no families. They want degeneracy because that they don't want people having a family or community to identify with. So they identify with product. They become atomized, debt-ridden consumers. So all this is being actively promoted in the name of liberty. And so it gets all the positive press. Now, one thing we learned is that not all protests are equal. We can't look at this programmatically and say just because there's a First Amendment and just because this group was able to protest and the press and the government responded to it well and sort of treated it with kid gloves or respected the people's rights to protest and assembly, that the other side's going to get the same treatment. A good example of that is what happened in Charlottesville in 2017, the Unite the Right rally, when apparently the local government down there, which is sort of a carpetbagger government, not really a Southern government, I think the mayor is like a Jewish guy from New York, you know, but it's a university town. So it's not really, it's different from the surrounding culture. But when they had this protest, and it was a protest there, they had all the permits and it was there to protest the removal of Confederate statues. But then the local government and the PD created a situation where they wanted violence. And so they could declare, they could declare an unlawful assembly and start the protest, but then get the optics of the violence. And so they could start this sort of this, anti-white, white supremacist fear that they're starting now. Recently, New Jersey Department of Homeland Security issued a warning for white supremacy terror alert. And in the warning, there's no specific group, or just there was just vague alerts, and there's some property damage. Probably inside. These when a synagogue gets spray painted or something, half the time, more than half the time, it's the rabbi doing it for to raise fears and increase fundraising. But the point is that it wasn't as if they're going to go down there and allowed to give speeches, make their case, and go home, because we don't live in a society where we have free speech, really. You only can exercise free speech if your speech it comports with the agenda of the establishment, the interest of the establishment. And we another example would be like the pro-life movement, where you had some of these protesters that they would invoke the strategies of the civil rights movement, where they would block abortion clinics. Now, this was praised by the this type of this tactic was praised in the 1960s by the press when it was protesting, Jim Crow and racism in the South, but then was employed to protest infanticide, abortion. In the 80s and 90s, it was declared illegal. In fact, the Operation Rescue was actually brought up on RICO charges to shut them down. And that trebles the damages. Eventually, that was overthrown by the court. But what they did was, and the press, when they're covering these events, always gave the protesters the worst coverage, So it's not equal. So again, if you're protesting, your protest will be treated well if you're a part, what you're fighting for, what you're protesting for, is part of the agenda of the establishment, or the powers that be. But if you're really challenging the power, speaking truth to power, they're going to come down on you hard, one way or another. We have this lawyer, Roberta Kaplan, who's using Lawfare, and she's suing some of the participants. And this isn't to say you don't have to agree with the Unite the Right rally. Maybe you want to take down the statues, but there's a lawful way to do that. The point is, this lawyer has admitted that her using Lawfare. That's what it is. Lawfare is the abuse of the legal system to go after political enemies. Now, when a lawyer admits that she's doing that, she should be disbarred and brought up on charges, because she's an officer of the court. And we all are supposed to have access to the court. The courts are supposed to be neutral in these things. It's politicizing the legal process, and she admits to doing that because she's going after these activists who she doesn't like. So,
Will there be any lawyers left if we actually
I know. It's just that bad. I know.
Well, right. The civil rights protests are a really good example of illustrate your point, because basically the powers that be were going to weaponize integration. We've done shows about this. And so it's a very subtle and well thought out structure to how they get this to work properly in terms of the media. First of all, like with the civil rights protests in the 60s, they had a legitimate point, which is that slavery still existed. If you look at the chain gangs, I've done a lot of study of what it was like in Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, after the Civil War. And basically, they were able to retain slavery through these very complicated kind of legal structure where they could basically create indentured servitude. And a lot of these are the individuals who then were taken up north, during when they were wanting to break up the Catholic neighborhoods in the northern cities. So they have this a situation in the South that has been, I think, basically deliberately let to ferment. You
Yes.
see what I mean? And now when they want to exercise the plan, they have this moral defense. Right there, they say we're going to have this march, and we have so much evil that is being done to these black people that we are really impossible to analyze our march from any perspective of could it be used by the oligarchs for, you know, ulterior or evil purposes? You see, they just are so well defended morally that the stories then that come about from the march are all one-sided. And really what the marches are for is not political, they're cultural.
Yeah.
The marches are to change culture. The marches are to make it impossible to question whether or not the oligarchs have weaponized integration.
Yeah, well, a good example would be like protesting for fair housing.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so how about you're protesting to break up ethnic neighborhoods?
Yeah, exactly. You know, so it's how yeah. it's spun, it's how it's characterized. And because they have such a legitimate moral, you know, basis to stand on.
They want justice.
Yeah, they want justice and they want it now. That it ends thinking. I mean, this is really, and that's when I say when their purpose is to change culture, really what they want to do is to put an idea in motion, indoctrinate people into it, and then stop any kind of questioning about how it's going to be applied. And it's so amazing to me when you look at those marches. And I actually was, involved in some of them. It wasn't really my issue. I was more anti-war, but on the college campuses, these things were always, you know, milling about. Mm-hmm. There were all kinds of protests against racism, you know, in the 60s when I was at school. So the thing is that in no instance was anyone going to be questioning any kind of deeper ulterior motive, right? It was just not possible at that time. But what's amazing to me, Tim, is that when you look at the condition of the inner city today, when you look at the complete absence of family, mm-hmm. and the complete triumph of violence, rap culture, I mean, the expression that women use of baby daddy, I believe it is now. Yep. There's no such thing as a father anymore. They just have a designation of who they think was the biological father, which is a complete acquiescence of culture, right? I mean, at that point, you just don't have any. You're just thought puppets of the welfare state, right? It's just the check comes in the mail or however, you know, money moves around. And the woman is barely even functioning as a mother because the culture is that debased. My point is that it is so catastrophic that you would think that there would be, you know, an obvious reappraisal of the process that got us here, right? But the marches that set up basically the Great Society programs, because believe me, integration was, it was going to be race mixing, right? But moreover, it was going to be welfare. This was like the way that the Great Society programs, meaning the name Great Society, you know, this was all going to be part of this new wave of support for the African American who had been, you know, enslaved and then legally enslaved in the South and had been discriminated against. And this was going to be a new cultural advent. You know, they were going to raise up themselves. And of course, those of us who are old enough, like myself, to remember like what Watts was like in like 1962 or 63. Tim, I mean, it's just been a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. It's just incredible, the destruction. And yet, because the moral platform was so cleverly constructed at the onset, that no one is even at this point saying, gee, was integration really a good idea? Were the protest march that really brought this concept into motion, you know, were they well thought out? Did they have a good result? No. I got into a discussion of it, and I said, and this was a feminist, and I, you know, and she was saying, well, you know, it's just a terrific thing. And I said, you know something? It's such a bad idea. I don't even think any kind of coherent person can even try to defend it at this point, because you can now see the results of it. You can see the results of feminism, of the integrated society, of the Great Society program, of welfare, of all of the different forces that were being told, people were being told were going to raise up the African American and just the inner city in general. You can see the result, right? So my point is that protest marches really need to be understood as powerful cultural tools. And so when we talk about, you know, is our protest marches a good idea? I would say, Tim, if you don't have a good understanding of kind of the cultural the power in back of them, you shouldn't be participating in them, because you really, you won't, you don't know where you're taking people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, because the type of society that created, you know, where you have no families, you create sort of a a feral generation, you know, which go out and wreak havoc, which has its own alchemical effect, you know, on society. Because then you have, you know, the reaction to that, the reaction of decent society to the forces of disorder and crime, and then the state can then use that to, you know, militarize the police force. Look at the drug war. And, you know, the same, you know, state that's you know, ruthlessly or viciously enforcing the drug war, parts of it are also facilitating the importation of drugs into the country, you know, which then flood these neighborhoods and have their effect. So again, you know, before you go out and protest something, you know what you're protesting against. And again, I think a lot of it is just there's an aesthetic to it, an appeal. Get out in the streets, and this is something that was promoted, you know, by the media in the 1960s. That this was it's just a certain, you know, same way that someone of a certain political leaning will have bumper stickers all over their car or something. It's just a question of taste and aesthetics. But it became kind of just a part of modern civic action, which ultimately was meaningless, really, because it didn't really change much, because much of that had already been decided, really. It didn't really end the Vietnam War when Nixon stopped the draft, that the protests died down, and then the war kind of wound down as it was going to eventually. And the, you know, and they moved on to other plunder. And you know, when you say, you know, America lost the Vietnam War, you have to ask yourself, what was the objective? You know, yeah, if it was to win a war and prevent the domino theory, yeah, we lost maybe. But then now, if you go into Walmart, you buy a shirt, you'll see made in Vietnam. So, who won?
Yeah,
you know, so that's how you have to look. And again, it's part of this globalist thing. These things. The understanding the hidden grammar of the civil rights movement was again the idea of then mobilizing the South and sort of the Jewish revenge on the South for Leo Frank was one way to look at it. But why are so many Jews behind, you know, Martin Luther King, Levinson, and you know, his handler? The irony is that, you know, the rather prominent role that Jews played in the slave trade, and now they're, you know, guiding the civil rights movement. Understanding that. Never has the black community ever been organized or powerful enough to really affect any change. Quite frankly, they have patrons because they are used as proxies, you know, and they, you know, they were used as proxies to bust up the ethnic neighborhoods, to help create suburbia, to have this vast cultural change that we saw in the late 60s and 70s to create the atomized society. And then you can unleash things like transgenderism and homosexuality. These things have a further effect on this. And then those groups can mobilize and protest. And because they're favored by the oligarchs, they're favored by the Fortune 500 companies, they'll get all positive press. And to the point now that, you know, a drag queen protest will get very... I've seen this. You're watching this, and the local news station will cover some sort of protest or just event. Cover it with kid gloves, like it's a great thing, and it's being promoted, and you'll see kids there. You know, that's why you on Good Morning America they had Desmond is Amazing, and Good Morning America was celebrating an 11-year-old transvestite or transgendered kid, supposedly. You know, I don't think it really exists. I think it's, you know, that these are just names that are applied to ways a person dresses or behaves. I don't think the condition actually exists really, but again, this is what you get. You know, it's so. You won't get the point is that, again, protesting, yeah, right to assemble, petition the government. But if you're really petition the government and you're really a burr in the saddle of the establishment, you will get no tolerance. In fact, they'll come down on you hard one way or another, whether it's, you know, police bashing down your door or lawsuits, or just, you know, you try to organize. What if the Southern Coordination Leadership Council, the Southern Christian Leadership Council, SCLC, they had been deplatformed? What if the credit card companies had refused to process their payment system, their bank accounts had been shut down, that Martin Luther King had been deprived of bank account to cash the checks he was getting from the Rockefeller Foundation? What if the system really didn't like Martin Luther King? They could have done that. And the moment that he was worth more dead than alive, he was taken out. And now him being dead as a martyr is much more useful to the establishment now. But I'm saying, what if that same intolerance being shown to certain groups now is being shown to the civil rights movement? It was.
Yeah, good question. And obviously the answer is it would have never gotten started. And it's hard to imagine what the country would be like. I mean, it's so, you know, structural to our nation at this point that people can't even imagine it. But yeah, it's a really good question. And I'll tell you, it's a really good idea to go to the origin, basically, of like a particular protest movement. Like with the civil rights, you can basically go to the Martin Luther King's and you can, you know, look out at the oligarchs' connection. Mm-hmm. I mean, for sakes, the Schiff family, the relatives of the Rothschild who'd been financing the slave trade are now arm in arm with Martin Luther King. I mean, you know, it seems a little suspicious. And then when you start looking at the weaponized integration concept, then, you know, you can see that they're basically manipulating both the young white people, the college people, and of course the black community into thinking that this is actually, this protest is taking us to a better world rather than a slave state. I would say that, you know, look at the progenitor basically film of the Holocaust, which mm-hmm. has, you know, the table with C.D. Jackson that Billy Wilder is filming, and you have a shrunken head on it that's absolutely 100% from the Amazon. So this, of course, sets up the platform. You can see that, well, where are we going with this concept? There's propaganda right at the very beginning. And in terms of a protest in the United States, I would go back to the Boston Tea Party. Mm-hmm. And I would say, well, wait a second, where is this coming from? I mean, why is this issue being, you know, used to energize, you know, the American mob with? Well, who's creating it? It's the Green Dragon Freemason Lodge. There's mm-hmm. there's no regular citizens in this event. If you're sitting at the dock watching the Green Dragon Lodge members dressed up as American Indians chanting and passing out pamphlets, you know, you might get swept up, but it would have been probably a good idea to stand back and go, well, who are you really representing? What is really the purpose? And why don't you, if you're having all this trouble with the King George, why don't you send the Masonic Lodge brother, Ben Franklin and Peyton Randolph, to talk to the king at his lodge and just work this out? Why do we have to kill all of these European males in order to establish freedom, which of course is kind of ludicrous, because if you just look at who's creating all of the foundation piece literature, you know, it's all this Masonic control. And so the whole thing looks fake. You see what I mean? When you go, and now when you look for, if you go, okay, well, that, if that is the case, if the way I'm characterizing it is accurate, then that kind of sets up all of the protests going forward. You see, you have to wonder.
You get the opposite of what you're protesting for.
You're being manipulated. And you see, this is...
Well, within a generation, you after the American Revolution, and Americans were living under a government far more powerful and burdensome than the King George's government ever was. Yeah. So, therefore, so much for liberty.
Good point. Yeah.
It was a joke said, King George, how's that taxation with representation working out for you?
So protest has to be carefully considered. I never did when I was a kid. I mean, you just get swept up in this stuff. But the fact is that the effects of protests have been very destructive in our country. Very destructive. The civil rights led to the Great Society program. program to the destruction of the African American culture. It led to integration, which broke up the ethnic communities that could have resisted oligarchic domination of the political system. You know, there's no way you can defend now. So that the protests were used as media events to shape culture. Mm-hmm. And you know, going forward, you just have to always bear that in mind.
And,
you know?
And break up nodes of real resistance to the corporate centralized state.
Exactly.
You know, just the cultural effect. You know, whereas prior to the 1950s and 60s, you had real interest being represented. This is true also with organized labor, but also with the Catholic ethnics, and there it's because of the demographics and the way they were dispersed or collected or they could coalesce rather and actually keep a short leash in Hollywood, and you could you know, the churches actually exercise real cultural power, political power. And in the name of protesting and freedom, and then everyone getting along and intermixing, and no one has any identity or agency, and then we're all just asked to vote every few years, you know, and just celebrate our liberty, you know, while we're being enslaved.
Yeah. I mean, look at chapter 23 of The Authoritarian Personality, where they talk about basically an ethnic attack against Europeans, and they specifically say we're going to use the propaganda of Eros, right? Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at like the 68 Paris Rebellion, you've got Danny the Red. I forget what was last name. He's just a Jewish anarchist.
Oh, Ben Codin?
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, his whole deal was, you know, free love, integration. I mean, he
was pedophilia daycare centers. Yeah,
it was just amazing that this purportedly political individual had exactly the same agenda that was going on in Woodstock. Mm-hmm. You know, so all of this, when you get protests, street protests,
there's the Green Party, right? German Green Party.
The Green Party was another example of it. You know, I think that in general. The real story about protests is that they have been used as cultural shapers by the oligarchs. And this is like one of the powerful tools they have, and I think it's an obvious fact. And I just don't really hear people talking about this. You know that when you have these people, you know, when you have movements in the street, you really have to be careful about who's leading them, where they're taking you, what is the backstory to all that.
Especially now, because it's been found out since then, especially with today's social media, with the color revolutions that were orchestrated using, you know, cellular technology, cell phones, and the swarming techniques that were perfected by the CIA. Now it's kind of outsourced to NGOs, but you can get, you know, you can get flash mobs organized to protest. And this has occurred during the Arab Spring. But even you mentioned you were in Paris in 68, and everyone knows that, the Rolling Stones song about it. And, you know,
Street Fighting Man.
Street Fighting Man. The William Engdahl wrote that the student uprising in 68 was an attempt by the CIA to undermine, weaken, and ultimately overthrow the De Gaulle regime. I think 2 years later they succeeded. The De Gaulle regime. This was for his intransigence regarding the U.S. dollar. There was the gold panic in the '60s because all the spending in the United States, and this was the final years of the Bretton Woods system, and France was calling in or at least making trying to redeem their dollar holdings for gold, is what the Bretton Woods system called for, and this was putting a lot of pressure on the American dollar. Germans were initially the ones to do it, but Germans were easily controlled. They backed down. But the student riots themselves were sort of stoked by the CIA to undermine the De Gaulle regime so that this would take pressure off the dollar. So the idea was, again, these situations, because everyone kind of looked at the situation in Paris, and why are the students protesting? Things are kind of good. What are they protesting, actually? And so he claims that the student riots were fomented by the CIA as retaliation for De Gaulle's pressure against the dollar. So again, although the students were protesting free love, I think it was during that protest that they threw copies of Wilhelm Reich's Mass Psychology of Fascism at the police. And that was sort of one of the protests, I guess, claims or demands was free love, going back to your Eros and the idea of using Eros. But nevertheless, the ability to stir up the youth to undermine the regime, and eventually worked. Although Nixon was forced to close the gold winter in 1971, in August 71, and set up the petrodollar system. But again, what you're looking at a protest. They're protesting. It's a cultural protest. It's a protesting. I don't know, maybe lower tuition, but really it's being manipulated by the powers that be for something they don't even understand, which would be moves against the French government for the French government's moves against the U.S. dollar. Again, exactly. You have no idea why you're out there. You're just out there. You're a proxy or a tool.
They just wanted nationwide chaos, mm-hmm. and to trigger it, they had the students, which, believe me, I can assure you, had no clear idea about what their protest.
Well, it's August. It's Paris. It's hot. It's summer.
There really wasn't a clear idea. But what happened was, is then the unions, who were under the control, I think, of basically agents, right? Mm-hmm. They then joined up, and that's when the whole thing got out of control. But it was all orchestrated. I haven't done any research in this a long time, but I can just guarantee you.
Well, I think at that point, any trade union, whether it's the AFL-CIO or French trade union, would have been infiltrated or somehow working with the Western intelligence agencies and the CIA. They're not going to.
That's right.
They're not going to be left alone.
So it was just another Boston Tea Party, Martin Luther King March. I mean, these are their larger cultural and geopolitical purposes for protest. And so, you just have to bear that in mind and protest, platforms tired of being maneuvered into protest by the oligarchs and try to get people to understand that, because, I really see us needing a information revolution. I mean, we need to have a vast number of people aware of the techniques and the purposes of the oligarchs to shape culture.
Effective protest would be, this isn't quite the optics, but with social media, internet, you got that with the alternative media. And it's a little wild, and I'm sure it's infiltrated, manipulated, and a lot of infighting and all that stuff. But it got to the point where they had to clamp down on it and shut it down, at least rein it in a lot with YouTube and Facebook. There was a interview, I think it was Leslie Stahl was interviewing, I think it might have been someone from Facebook. And they said, Leslie Stahl's looking at some of the postings or something. Maybe might have been Google, and says, some of the postings which Leslie Stahl, member of the press, says, well, this is hate speech. How did you tolerate this? What's hate speech?
Hate speech is analysis that you can't refute.
It's something. It's someone saying something you disagree with. It says, the response should have been as well. Define hate speech for me. Give me a reason why I spend these. People's right to free speech or to communicate and organize. I mean, to me, again, this would be a case for if the government were representing the interest of the people and acting in good faith, they could make a very strong case that the tech companies, the internet, the social media, these are all kind of public utilities at this point. Because for one thing, they've been heavily funded by the taxpayer. They were created. The internet and these things is all taxpayer funded. Silicon Valley, Google was funded by the CIA, Inkytel, same with Facebook and other things. So there's the public has a stake in them. And not to mention the fact, even banks that shut down payment systems, credit card companies, they operate interstate. Now, if the federal government can tell a bed and breakfast or a restaurant who they have to serve, they can't discriminate because they buy ketchup, something from out of state. So the government has a right to regulate their business. I'm sure they could find a pretext to regulate banking and financial services that they have to outside. They could say saying unless a person has committed a crime, then you cannot suspend these services for them.
Well, look at the Google algorithm changes over the last six months, where they are now literally censoring, any concept that might go against the government narrative. I mean, yes. I was looking today. I wanted to see videos of the protests that the Truth Movement had put on in New York that that basically had surrounded Geraldo Rivera at one point and were chanting "Inside Job." I don't know if you remember this. It's gone, disappeared down. You know, and so what they're so this is censorship at a very treasonous level. And yet nothing is, you know, you can't really protest against it because the media is so controlled. So, again, the internet, you know, is worse and worse every day. They're getting more and more, at least in the large DARPA funded platform.
Yeah. There was some MMA fighter whose son had an adverse reaction to vaccines and I think died. And he posted it on Facebook, and it was taken down.
Yeah. So that's the thing. This is censorship. They're obviously this is direct violation of the First Amendment. Direct.
Yes.
They're doing it for political purpose, and they're discriminating him away from all of the pro-vaccine concepts. I mean, whatever you make of the issue.
Well, the thing is that type of protesting, meaning that you're availing yourself of your First Amendment rights because of technology, you don't have to go to a city and hang out with 100,000 people and protest. You can do it digitally and get the word out. That's very effective. They don't mind you showing up and protesting, you know, either getting beaten up or, you know, but, you know, they don't mind if you're out there protesting to, you know, kill your unborn baby or to commit sodomy. They love that. Go ahead, go to town on that. But if you're out there actually organizing, communicating with people, providing information, just engaging in a debate. I'm not saying you'd have to be right on the issue, but the fact that they have to shut it down so hard should make you suspicious that they don't have an argument against it. They just got to shut it down.
You know, it's interesting to, like, how would, like, Google be protested? You know, I mean, you know, you have, like, one kind of protest that actually had good effect. I mean, to at least it achieved, I think, the political goal it had was the boycott of grapes in California. I don't know if you remember this, but
Chavez.
The Chavez organized, it was like a financial protest that people would stop buying grapes. And it was pretty successful. I don't remember the data, but I remember they did actually get some changes in the work regulations for these guys. And he had a pretty good platform to stand on because some of them, you know, they were here illegally, typically. Mm-hmm. Work hours and things. And so Chavez had a good platform to stand on. He got a lot of people to stop buying grapes, and that kind of worked. I don't think you could really organize that kind of a financial boycott today. I mean, some people have tried it with Israel, and you can see that, you
they
know,
passed laws against it.
Yeah, they made that illegal, so that didn't work. But I think that you know, like, if you wanted to protest Google, you can use other platforms for search engines, but I'm not sure any of them are really ultimately any fairer than Google. I like the approach that you took, where you continue to post like powers and principalities as a page on YouTube, but then don't give any text to it or audio. You just have a link to platforms that are basically don't censor us at the moment, you know? And so that's a really creative idea of a protest of a form, which actually is basically just clever use of technology. It's the kind of thing that we have to think about going forward, because this is, the area that we can protest in. You see what I mean? I think the street protests, you know, I don't know what future that has. I think that's, unfortunately, mass media just overwhelms it. It just takes whatever.
Yeah. If you're protesting something, if your protest actually goes against the interest or the agenda of the powers that be, it'll be crushed one way or another. If it serves interest, it'll be promoted. That's the rule.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be white supremacist.
White supremacist, that's another term out there. It's white supremacy now.
Yeah, if you it's like, say, like, well, we're tired of, like, having our population reduced and our ethnicity disrespected and dissolved, you know, that would be, you know, atrocious white supremacist.
Yeah, you know, you should start like a Project 85, And the Project 85 would be get the white population back to 85% of the population. See how that would be treated. Well, the funny thing, I had a discussion about that white supremacy is when they signed the Hart-Celler Act in 1965, Lyndon Johnson, fixed his name to it. Promises were made that it would not change the country's demographics, meaning that the white supermajority of close to 90% would be maintained. So they're acknowledging the demographic importance of demographics in politics. So they were, in essence, admitting that they themselves were white supremacists, right? They're saying that the white majority is going to maintain its dominance. And the idea was, what we're doing is we're extending the privileges and immunities and benefits of American society to minorities. This is it. You're going to participate in it. But obviously the intent was there to dilute the population for cultural and political reasons that we're seeing today, is that there is an explicit anti-whiteness now. It's on the chopping block by a certain group for a specific reason, because that group is able to potentially to have agency and protect their interests. Whereas the other minority groups, they're in it because they see the country as a pinata. You know, they want to plunder it and they're not going to pose any real threat to it. And so their vanity will be tickled, and they'll be told they're going to have power. They're not going to have any power. The brown people aren't going to have any power. I'm sorry. It's not in the agenda. So, you know.
Yeah, boy, that is true. It is the brave new world is not a world where, you know, the multicultural clump has any power. Mm-hmm. I've said this over and over again that, you know, they, in fact, a really good template to look at would be inner city African Americans. Mm-hmm. I mean, you think where they were in the 60s and look where they are now, and look at the lies, the fantasies, and the deliberate social engineering to demolish them on the part of the government secret society. That was real. I mean, you know, freeway Ricky Ross and the CIA's insertion of crack cocaine, that mm-hmm. was real. The promises of Martin Luther King and of LBJ in terms of grace, that was nonsense. That was just the cover story to break them up, to break up their family structure in the same way they were working against the Catholics at the same time. They're not taking the inner city. I mean, you know, the inner city is really the avant-garde. That's really what Americans should be looking at. That's what the oligarchs want for the entire community before they exterminate us, is to basically shatter us to the extent where there are no families, no ethnic pride, nothing that can resist, and then we're going to get wiped out. And, now we look at this pandemic, which... I don't know about you, I've been following John Rappaport, a very interesting analysis about, you know, how it could just be completely fake and it's just a way of control, basically. Mm-hmm. But irrespective, it is something that sets up the possibility for the citizen that, you know, draconian and novel control elements could be, you know, hoisted on us very quickly.
Well, what the whole vaccine paradigm sets people up for, it's implied in that, at least strongly suggested, is that at some point the necessity of mandatory vaccinations, because you don't have a right to, you know, I've heard people make this argument where you don't have a right to spread the contagion. So now you have to get it.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is it in the Patriot Act? I was asked that question today. I didn't know.
It's 500 pages? There's probably something in there somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I read it every day, but yeah. I just didn't know. And I was just wondering if you knew, because it is kind of, that would be sort of a warning indicator of where we're about to head.
Yeah.
So this would be something, you see, this would be like, so how do you protest? Say, you know, that mandatory vaccinations are coming. And we don't want to put this stuff in our body. How do you protest that? What would be effective? Well, street protests might work and it might help, you know, get some political traction. But I think there's also the need for, you know, just a data. If you look at, there's a lot of really heroic people on the internet who are spreading information about the dangers of vaccinations, right? This group needs to become more visible. Mm-hmm. And that is a kind of protest. It's a protest against the intellectual, the sophistry, right, of the government and the vaccine industries. to force us into accepting the mandatory vaccinations that could be coming for everyone in, gee whiz, 2 months.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I guess if you trust the CIA, why not trust the CDC?
Right, exactly. Yeah, so it's just, so protesting, Tim, I don't know. I mean, it's, I haven't participated in any that have worked, but the concept is very valuable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, idea, again, being able to express yourself and share your ideas in the hopes of either keeping your government at bay or influencing your government. But, protest changes. It changes along with the available technology. And I do think the idea of in the streets actually is just that's largely theatrics. It can be easily manipulated and used against the very people who are protesting, as we saw in Charlottesville with the press coverage. Most people think it was a hate event, as you might say, Nazis showed up in these things. People don't realize that actually there was the Heffey report, that Timothy Heffey was a former federal prosecutor who actually was commissioned a report to actually put the blame on the city government, even the state government, for creating the conditions for the riot. And they wanted the riot.
So what should they have done? I mean, I think that...
Well, there are procedures. As soon as Antifa showed up, by the way, Antifa itself is an interstate criminal enterprise and should be investigated such by the FBI because they do violence. In fact, there's laws against showing up with masks, which weren't enforced. You can do that. It's very effective in keeping people from doing these things. You can simply separate the protest. Other cities have done this and have had relatively peaceful protests when they were acting in good faith. I think Washington State had a few protests. Seattle had some protests like that, or maybe in Portland out there. But there's ways to do this where you keep the group separated. But also, if you want violence to ensue, you don't keep them separated. In fact, you can actually drive. What they did in Charlottesville, the police chief, who was eventually forced to resign, said, let them fight it out. That way we can declare unlawful assembly and then stop the event. So they wanted disorder. They wanted violence. And then after the event, they go after, some of the people who were attacked were being prosecuted. And they have it on videotape of them actually being attacked. They're just defending themselves,
Of course. I think that, going forward, people who organize these things should be aware of the clever manipulation of both the media and also the physical terrain by the government. And they need to come up with a strategy against that. I suggest the coffee table. Instead of marching, which is always kind of militaristic, just sit down with coffee tables and pamphlets.
It's provocative, yeah. Whereas,
And what you do is you focus more on the analysis of your perspective. You try to say, we're here, First Amendment, we want to talk. We've got some data here, we're passing out the pamphlets, and we would like to engage people so that the public can see what the strength of our analysis, and also the public can see that they're missing a lot of the facts when they look at these issues, when they hear the term white supremacist, when they see the videotapes of people cartwheeling in the air because a car is driving through a crowd. It's just this manipulation needs to be exposed. I just think that, going forward, the organizers would do well to try to think about how they will be manipulated into into a perspective that are against what these movements stand for. Whereas I think there are some ways that it can be done, to really engage the public. I think, and even though this wouldn't be kind of my normal temperament, I would personally advocate extreme nonviolence, and to the extent of just sitting down and coffee tables, because when you march, when you confront and yell, these are all just, they're so easy to, these things are so easy to manipulate. So you really need to train your protesters how to basically overcome this and to try to find a way to get the information out on the broad scale. To me, it's all the protest is a success if, as a result of it, a lot of people get information they didn't have before. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be how I would.
Another thing is know how to protest. Good example is, let's say you are someone of a conservative temperament, and you're from Virginia, and you like Virginia's history, its heritage, and you like the statues and the names of the schools being named after, like Stonewall Jackson or General Lee, and these things. Why are the names being changed? Why are these statues being torn down? At the time, the protest isn't when that decision is taken to take the statues down, because it's too late. The time to protest or face some resistance is maybe years before, when the demographics of the state are changing, and maybe you should be protesting your big business friends who want cheap labor.
Well, that's right.
Because that's the effect of, because once you flood the area with migrants from Central America, then I can give a darn about General Lee and Stonewall Jackson and the state's heritage. They're coming up here to make a buck. They're mercenaries, you know, and they're going to be manipulated by business and other interests. So it's far too late. So the ugly reality is, when you acquiesced on things on the cultural issues and the immigration issues, you're setting yourself up to be defeated on these issues, because your area is being flooded. You're being outnumbered eventually, you know.
Absolutely. That's a great point. Really well said. That's exactly right. Is that the protest has to be realistic to what's going on at the moment of protest. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, General Stonewall Jackson, I'm afraid, is not on the issue right now. You see what I mean?
It's just,
we've got, when you've got, glyphosate in the food and, the first graders are having transgender, story hour. I mean, you have some issues that are really a little more important. I mean, Mayor Pete, what is his last name? The Buttigieg, homosexual.
Buttigieg, apparently it's a Maltese name.
He's a spook. I mean, the guy was.
Sorry, Joe, you're breaking up.
Can you hear me?
You're breaking up. Now can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Can you hear me?
About Mayor Pete. Pete Buttigieg.
Well, anyway, so Mayor Pete, he's a spook. But my point is last week, he helped a 9-year-old boy closet. Did you see that news story? He was in some public meeting, and some little young man came up and Pete, basically got him to feel good about being homosexual. He's 9 years old.
Okay, that's called grooming.
Right. And it's also...
I want to. I want someone to ask him, have you ever had relations with an underage boy?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a legitimate question. I mean, they certainly go after heterosexual politicians for, illegal activity. So why isn't this one, one?
Well, he's the one that endorsed a mentoring program for homosexuals.
Federal. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the idea of an issue that, I think if you approach it as an information problem, that the public just doesn't have the data about really what is in back of this and about what this Pete guy represents, this would be timely. And if it's presented in the right way, you might get information about basically the agenda that has existed, right, to promote deviant sexual activity, and you could expose the people who are involved back of it. See, people aren't aware of it. They're given the idea that this is diversity, and that, see, this is how they never go beyond that concept into the idea, well, there's analytics here, there's like who's in back of all this? How did it come about? That's what, Stonewall Jackson, I'm sorry, it's just, that isn't something that's really going to, connect into our world and make it a little, the public able to defend themselves better.
Yeah, but it's all part of the demoralization of the, of the white majority that we're seeing.
Sure.
So, yeah. Okay, Joe, I think we covered it.
Yeah, I think so, Tim. It was a pleasure talking to you tonight, and I look forward to next week.
Okay, enjoy your weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.